us, and we call upon someone who's dedicated his career to the very issues that Lorach Yomim is all about, to addressing issues regarding halacha and healthcare delivery. I introduce to you Rabbi Solomon Shapiro, Director of Pastoral Services, Kingsford Jewish Medical Center, who will discuss home care, healthcare delivery. Rabbi Shapiro.
The Reuven Becker is doing a very good job, I would say, of bringing certain issues to the forefront regarding health care. I have spoken previously at several of the seminars regarding nursing home care, the issues that are involved there. Now the thrust seems to move from institutionalization to home, because we are dealing now with covered up ears, dignity of man, the dignity of the human being. And it's far more dignified for a family man or for a family woman to be at home, regardless of their physical condition. They're far more comfortable at home. The environment is pleasanter. The surroundings are encouraging. But they need a little help. And this is where the home care program comes into play. You've heard from the previous speakers, I'm sure. I'm sorry I'm mishearing them. I know you have had people on the program, such as Ms. Judy Brickman, very knowledgeable, and Ms. Rosen, well, very familiar with the program. And they told you about the different type of home care programs that are available to different people suffering from different conditions. And the dignity that is provided to the one who is not capable of taking care of himself or herself. But there are also some halachic ramifications here. How does the halacha look at this? And what are the weaknesses there? And how can we overcome them? We have to divide a condition into two categories. One is what is called in the Talmudic vernacular, a critically ill person, and one who is not critically ill, one who can live at home, but at the present moment requires a certain amount of attention. He's not ambulatory enough to take care of his own needs. Lowly, the individual is a lowly. There is no immediate family. Here comes into question a very simple shaila that we have in the Shulchan Aruch. The question of Yichud. Can we put a man and a woman together in the same room for a given period of time without somebody overseeing you? The Rambam is very specific on that. The Rambam in Hilchos Yisurei Biyah tells us Perek Chof Beis, Halacha Aleph, that Isur Yichud Noyik B'chol Yishu. Every woman has a prohibition of being miyakat, to be alone with a male partner, with a male friend, in the same room behind the closed door. Bein Zekeino, irrespective and regardless of her age, whether she's old, Bein Yalda, she can be young. But Chachomim Gazru, Al Kol Yichud, any form of Yichud, is prohibited. V'chein Bamashu, The same law applies to men too. A chilek, there is no rav kinnita, there's no difference bein bochor v'zochor, between a young man and an older man. V'apnita is zochor muflim, regardless of his age, usher miyuch. So this question comes into play. How do we handle a situation where there is no one to take care of the patient of the individual who is not critically ill, but needs assistance at home care center, a nice young woman to take care of her? Are we going to transgress that prohibition of Yichud? That's a question. And there is also a issue to be miyachad, to be alone with a non-Jewess and a non-Jew. And in today's environment, let me introduce something else. And the Shulchan Aruch already alludes to that. There is a issue of Yichud also in Zohar. Today that homosexuality is now out of the closet, there isn't that shaila. That's a question we have to address. How do you handle it? The second shaila is shmius. The dignity of the human being. The dignity of man. Can a woman handle him if he needs assistance in private matters? Or vice versa? We're talking now about home environment, not institutionalization. We're not talking about a chodesh yesh b'sakom. We're not talking about a critically ill person. We're talking about one who has full possession of his or her faculties, is capable of thinking, making decisions for himself or herself, but at the moment has a physical impediment which eventually may be cured. You know, there's long-term and short-term home care, am I correct? In a short-term situation, the patient will go into society once again. Long-term is another problem. So these are the two shadows that we have on home care during the week. Then comes the Shaila on Shabbos. How do we handle it on Shabbos? I've seen people who were at the present moment could not walk the shul. There was an enormous wheel accident. Both of his legs are in cast. He needed help to get to the synagogue. Otherwise the man was in perfect health. But he has nobody at home. And I saw that there was an attempt to take care of her. There is no hot water. Could she make tea for him, Hashem? She allowed to cook for him, Hashem? Is he considered a chodesh yesh b'ei sakon? Or do we handle him as a chodesh ein b'ei sakon? His life is not being threatened. He's not going to succumb from this. In a few weeks, you'll be okay again. How do we treat him on Shabbos? What do we do with him on Shabbos? What is permissible and what is not permissible? What may be done, what may not be done in this particular case for this particular individual? So when we talk in terms of home care, let us not think for one moment that it does not have halachic problems associated with it with regard to Jewish patients. There are halachic issues. For a chodesh yesh b'ei sakon, one whose life is in danger, I could cook on Shabbos, I could, Ramacha told us, to be the Shulchan Aruch, Milchus Shabbos, and the Shinit Ches, tells us you can slaughter an animal, and prepare it cook it for, we give it to Ben Shabbos. Situation changes when we deal with the Chola Shein Bo Yisrael Korban, when there is no danger to his life. How do we handle Ben Shabbos? What may we do, what may we not do? I mean, all these are questions I'm sure that the professionals in the industry so far have not addressed, because that doesn't come to their attention. They have to be concerned with finding a suitable caretaker for this patient and for this particular condition. I'm not here to solve your problems, nor do I intend to solve the problems, but I just do want to alert that the Jewish public should be aware that there are gray areas, there are dark areas, of course there are bright areas as well, but there are problems with home care vis-a-vis the halacha that we cannot dismiss and we cannot overlook. When you go to look for the proper caretaker for the one you love who's going to be in a home environment, we must take into consideration the halachic factors as well. There are certain medications that may be given to a very sick person. There are certain medications we can't give to one who's not very sick. There are certain things we can do for them. I shall be seeing young people. Some are rabbinic prohibitions, some are biblical prohibitions. Some is delegating authority to a non-Jew. Called the Shabbos, and some things we can't do. So it's not all black and white. There are gray areas. And the most important thing is, we do have to pray for good health. That everyone should be privileged to have a long life and a good life, go without uncle to the elephant. Not to home care, not to hospice, not to be concerned with end-of-life issues, which are mind-boggling, I know. The previous speaker touched upon end-of-life issues, and there are many, many problems that are associated with that. Now, I deal with that on an ongoing, daily basis. Do you resuscitate? Do you not resuscitate? Do we keep someone alive, or do we just let nature take its course? These are problems that are an ongoing situation, day in and day out. So we pray that God should give good health to everyone, a long life.
Thank you, Mr. Curl. Before introducing the next speaker, I should like to also acknowledge the presence of a friend of our Yomim, Rabbi David King, who's chaplain at the New York Hospital Center in Queens. From my personal experiences with him in trying to develop some of these programs, I know he's been remarkably responsive and helpful. I'm sure anyone who has or will have the occasion of calling upon him will get the same compassion and assistance. So thank you very much, Rabbi King. Our next speaker is Rabbi Yosef Stern, the Rabbinic Coordinator of Jewish Hospice of Greater New York. He will talk about hospice and end-of-life issues. And personally, I very much look forward to his presentation. He's a known scholar and writer, and also translated by Semitic, for whom I have special affinity to. I'm looking forward to Rabbi Stern's hadracha and actually addressing some of the issues that I've had personally. Unfortunately, I too have had the need and occasion of family member needing hospice care and have had similar concerns and dilemmas with regard to the appropriateness of use of hospice. I was concerned in particular with regard to the very issue that was raised by Moshe Borowski, that is, just by definition, the federal government says that you are entitled to hospice only if life expectancy is 6 months or less. How halakhically can one label somebody in a hospice program? I'm looking forward to Rabbi Stern's hadracha.
Around 3:03 p.m. this afternoon, my cell phone rings, and it's Ruvain, and he tells me two things. First of all, he said, I'll make the test a little bit easy. The best kind of test, and I do teach in school also, is when the students know the questions beforehand. And he said, I'll pop the question to you now. You just heard the question, whether or not Halacha agrees with the legal definition of what hospice care entails. And as a good Jew does, I'm not going to answer the question directly, but I hope by the time we get done with this, the sense of the question will be there. And then he told me something which I'm not going to threaten you with. He told me I have a little more time because one of our featured speakers, Greenberg, is not going to be here today. I will not utilize that opportunity. It's late enough. Truth is, let me start by saying what I'm not. And if I told you all the things I'm not, you'd be here till tomorrow. I am not the postage of my agency. I'm not the postage of Metropolitan. We're very fortunate, as Moshe told you, to have Rav Scheinberg, who is an acclaimed postage and medical ethics. He is our halakha consultant. Now, nonetheless, with that disclaimer, like it says on the cereal box and all the other things, don't take it too seriously, with all those disclaimers, let's see if we can skirt and touch upon some of the parameters. Not so much to give the answers, but to phrase the questions better. In Hebrew, we have a saying that she'elas chacham katzi tshuva. The way I ask a question is half of the answer. And specifically, I'd like to just share with you some thoughts on telling the patient their diagnosis / prognosis, the question of victory, of confession, saying the final truth, which is so, so important, when to do it, how to do it. Maybe a word about a ghost, what in the language of the trade is called actively dying. Something, and I hope not to use too much time, something about the level of care we give. Is it ever halakhically okay? I'm not going to say I know the answers, but again, just to pose the questions, is it ever okay to say, well, we're not going to do something? And then, of course, after 120 years, the Kavanah Mace, funerals, and so on. Let me just start with a bracha. I think the best bracha we can give Reuven is that the name of his agency or his group will come true to him, which is Orev Yomim. That you see that many, many good years, and maybe not doing this because we won't even need any of this. Hopefully it'll be a time to see us on Mason and Synthesis. Let's start with the diagnosis. I had a wonderful rough and flatfish. One of my dear Balabatin was calling Rebel Foyle for short. Wonderful year. He went to Adopt Yenish year, and I saw he stopped coming. Well, what's wrong? I can't really tell you, and it turns out he'd undergone biopsies, various tests, and then I saw he was a total ice mess. Couldn't go anywhere. I asked his son, actually his son told me this a long time later, son the doctor himself. Sunday morning, just after many inconclusive tests, Sunday morning he's eating breakfast, and again, this doesn't usually occur. I'm not that this old doctor, he has a very wonderful one. This particular one called him up Sunday morning, and said, Ray, you got 6 months to go, and hung down the phone. And he wanted to tell the doctor, you just killed me, but the doctor wasn't on the phone long enough. Now, this doesn't happen always, or not all doctors do it, but the point I want to bring out, and I'm using this extreme case, is there's a very good reason when wherever possible, we don't, not so much tell. As I just mentioned, we have a team every Monday morning. I was speaking about a team today. We meet as a holistic group of social workers and nurses. And I said, we stay away from the D word. You have a few months to live. You have 6 months to live. If that's the state's definition, we're pragmatic enough to work with it. But we don't have to kill the patient. You look in Medrash, now homiletic literature, when Moshe Rabbeinu tells Aaron, now the time has come to go up to Ha-Ha-Ha and pass away. Look in the Medrash if you can, and you'll see how with such tact and sensitivity, Moshe informs his brother that now he's going to die. And he takes him back to the story of Otto Marichon, the first man has to die, and Aaron has his brother, something like that. Everybody has to die? Well, yes, even everybody. And eventually, he understands what his faith is. Sensitivity is so important. Some of us may have heard of perhaps one of the most brilliant geniuses that Judaism has ever produced, Rabbi Yosef Rosen in Rogichon. Back when the gentleman was not, this is not the way he was, so the gentleman was not observing himself. He had been a student of Einstein and the Rogichon. He knew them both. And he said that the Rogichon was 10 Einsteins. In 1936, when the Rogichon was enduring his last illness, and those that anybody went to Vienna to the hospital, and one of the doctors told him, Rabbi Rosen, you're going to die. And he told him, I know, but you should not have told me. It's the insensitivity. The great Moshe Feinstein, that's how I've always felt, that with very rare exceptions, almost always, never say so in as many words. I know a kid, I don't want to say where, Ryan Harder, who had bone cancer for 2 years, and never been told what's going on. In fact, I almost put it out because I saw him walking out of the bus a couple of weeks ago. I wanted to say, I'm you getting off the bus? Both assembly in a hurry. And so there's really no need, in my humble opinion, on the outside, to give a patient maybe a diagnosis, but certainly in a form. Zalman Auerbach, the great post-it emphasizes that. I recommend anybody who can handle the Hebrew to look in the Nishmat Avraham, which is a great sefer put out by Rabbi Avraham, who was the head of internal medicine at Shari Tzedek Hospital, and he quotes the Shlomo Zalman, the major time when they have to tell a patient a diagnosis, people know they're ill. And you know something, in my chaplaincy experience, they know fully what was going on. But it's the articulation of that, that's another death sentence. You don't have to tell it. And the truth is, you find this in halacha. Says a relative, one of the commentators, it says that if a terminally ill patient has lost a relative, you shouldn't tell about the passing of his relative. You don't tell him about the passing of his relative, you can tell him about his condition. If somebody's sitting shiva and they have to visit, they're about to visit their relative, take off the kriya garment, take off the garment. The Rambam says you're visiting somebody who's terminally ill, tell happy stories. The ambiance is of such critical importance. We had a person in the hospital when I started working, and he was revoked because he was doing a little better. Then I go to a kiddush for an uproot, and this particular individual asked me what I'm doing there. I was very tempted to ask what he's doing there. The answer is he's there because a bunch of them wanted him there. You don't know how well he can do. Which leads us to the flip side. On the other hand, I'm only going to go another 2 hours. On the other hand, there is a need to do one thing from our halachic viewpoint, which is so important and so difficult, and there's ever a time to indirectly tell that's the time. And that is to say vidur. Loosely translated the final phrase, but really the confession. The Mishnah tells us in Sanhedrin that the person who is vadeh, they confess, so you have a portion in Olam Haba and the world to come. And frankly, it's worth doing almost anything, doing cartwheels, to get the person to say a vision. Let me share with you one story where Hashem helped you. It was about 2.5 years ago on Labor Day, and there was a close thing you get to a tornado in New York, and I was going on the D train. I intended to go home, and I chose to back to Flatbush. And there was a tree stuck on the tracks. I wound up taking the B train, wound up in Borough Park, figured, all right, once I'm there, let me go to our inpatient unit, which is the 5th floor of Metropolitan Nursing Home. Meanwhile, there was a patient there who had visited my home, and immediately after I was brought to the inpatient unit, and the only thing this patient wanted to talk about was gout. And you know what kind of gouter I am? You can imagine there really wasn't much to talk about. And Not so many people can fail God from mid-course, but some can. And finally I said, listen, you get better than this, you're trying to play golf. And we never want to say visually in a terrible thing. That day was his 75th birthday. That day the family was there. And since I wound up thanks to that tree, an unanticipated visit, this particular individual said visually about 4 days before he was here. And so it's so important to do so. How is always a question. Timing is a question. So it's a slippery slope. On one hand, you don't want to say, you don't need to say. I've never found a case, maybe I'm wrong, I've never found a case where a patient needs to be told you're going to die within a certain period of time. They know they don't have to be told, but you do have to say that it's so important. And how you do that is one of the great challenges I could focus to help all those who have the chance to do so. We know that Jesus said even on Shabbos with a patient, and it may be said, you know, daven, if the ambiance isn't appropriate, isn't clean and so on, which may happen because of the care of the patient, visually may be said. Let's talk for a moment about what in the language is called actively dying. We call this a ghostase. A ghostase is considered to be alive, halachically, except at a coin, you can go there. People sometimes go to they maintain the vigil by their relative, which is very nice. They also talk about funeral arrangements at that time. And I tell you, there's one thing that gets me upset, it's that. Let's talk. Can you do the funeral? Not now. Thank God he's alive. And it's so important. I think the author of the Shiva Tavron is out. A person may be apparently comatose and knows. And I spoke to Dr. Taylor about physician. There's a great deal that people may hear. Don't ever talk about these types of things in the presence of a colon. And so the concept of the ghost age may not be moved. What happens? This happens sometimes in units when the patient has to be moved to because of the needs of another patient. These are all in Shiloh. And the patient should never be moved without halachic guidance. A question that happens often, I'm not going to try to resolve this time, but I just want you to realize this is an issue, is that family members want to touch, they want to stroke, they want to administer in some way the needs of a person who is chain-stoking, basically, who's breathing is very late, but it needs to be suctioned to clearly as a ghost. I would just say seek halakhic guidance as to whether any kind of touching may be permitted. Talking about, and very often the issue comes up in terms of end of life and resuscitation. Let me just touch on one point. There's a great deal of misconception about what a halakhic living will be. One of the things I did not expect to be such a struggle, and there may be some real reservations, but most of it I found are major misconceptions. Somehow it was the idea that somebody's going to manage my life and that of my children and grandchildren for young forever. All halakhic living will mean is what any Orthodox Jew does when your milk and meat get mixed up, which is to ask a child. All halakhic living in the world means, and certainly I can say in our auspices, that you either our halakhic consultant of Shangri or your Rav will be the one who will determine halakhic issues. It doesn't mean anything more, it doesn't mean anything less. And I wish many of the misconceptions and too much of the opposition we find could be dispelled at that point were made clear. Other thing I want to talk about is briefly two of them. And that is, what do I have to do for a patient? Basically, and this is the area which you always have to ask the shaman. Moshe Feinstein and Sal felt that basic nutrition, and oxygen, and IV, and energy tubes, insulin, these types of things must be done. You know, we don't dehydrate people. Supposedly the lingo is out in the trade, that's the best way to die. Chazal did not feel like that. Our rabbis tell us that it's that soma is touching the kulam. To die of thirst is the worst way to die. We can't allow such a thing. We've had patients transferred to us because somehow somebody told them we just don't do dehydration. That's against our law. The issue that does come up is do I have to do more than that? And Moshe addresses that. I will just say that a child has to be asked certain kinds of medicines, a lot of pain. I would say that if doing these things could make the patient worse, of course, that's very often a good reason not to do so. Here is where, if you signed our lockers with your will, your process will be insulted. Now, the question of morphine. And very often families have to be convinced there is nothing wrong halakhically with administering morphine as much or anything to as much as needs to be done.
So Mr. Zalman Auerbach, the great postage, discusses this question. And while it's certainly not possible to do a mercy killing, you can't kill the patient with one dose of morphine, but Shlomo Zalman says that if the cumulative effect of giving many doses of morphine is to hasten the death, even that is good. That's a very important point to stress, that painkillers are important. Again, ask your local postage, but I think this will help you frame the shiver. Let me end by speaking about the end, but only the end, of course, on this earth. And by the way, very often part of the job is to deal with questions of theology, why is this happening to me, the concept of kavod ha'mes. I don't know if it's a pleasure or a tragedy or both, but one of the nice things in a way in this job is I get an opportunity to arrange for people who have not had levayas, according to our halachic means, to do so the right way. I mean, sometimes you can sit and plead and cajole, but it makes a big difference and it's well worth it. I want to end with a story and a tefillah. I was visiting somebody, then comes the bereavement, a post-bereavement, which is very much part of the job. We stay in touch with the people, very important. I was visiting somebody, this perhaps was the most tragic case, a young person, about 41 years old, passed away from a brain tumor. Shortly after I started working in the hospital. And I visited a family that was only a father, the parents, and they had a daughter who unfortunately married the guy. It was just one particular person that was, this was really their only sibling, their only child for practical purposes. And I come 6 months later and I say to them, what am I going to do? How can I help them? I know I have to do something for you. The family is still distraught, they're beside themselves, how are they going to function? And I come over and I say, okay, I'm going to do something for you today. And I uttered a little prayer to myself, a better word. And I said, you know, Mr. So-and-so, you're going to put on tefillin from here on. And I actually expected to be physically dislodged. It was like the third floor. I expected to be on the street in a minute. And he said, okay, Rabbi, but I have two questions. The first question is, I don't know how to put on tefillin. Well, that I can do for the other ones. I can't afford to buy a pair. That's something else. But with the help of a sofa, we were able to do it. Somebody donated a pair of tefillin, the man wears tefillin every day, and Baruch Hashem, well, certainly didn't erase the mental loss he suffered, the person is doing better. I think the point we can then take is that we ask our Kodesh Baruch Hu, yes, there's life beyond life, and there's life for the end stages of life in this world. To end on a very topical note, today's been a difficult day. We're following the news, in Eretz Yisrael, fighting, Tsaras, dissension, people have been injured on our side, riots in the Arab part. We ask our Kodesh Baruch Hu to take all our Tsaras and put them to an end. That indeed, there shouldn't be a need for any of this skilled nursing care. Now, Kodesh Baruch Hu talk about, Mafa Hashem will continue to upon him at a time come when my cell phone will only ring for Simchas in these days.
Thank you. At this point, we have a special opportunity of hearing someone who has the professional expertise to actually be a presenter who's very prominent in the field of bioethics and medical ethics, and who's at the same time a community Yaskin friend. Talk about his personal experiences with regard to hospice and home care. It's my pleasure now to introduce Dr. Alan Bennett, who's certainly also available for any geriatric consultation. Dr. Bennett.
The story is told of the all-day seminar where there's speaker after speaker after speaker and people are leaving after each speaker. Finally, there's one speaker left and there's one person in the audience. The speaker thanks the person sitting in the audience for holding out to hear his speech, and the fellow in the audience says, what are you talking about? I'm the next speaker. here tonight wearing very many different hats in regards to home care, in regards to hospice care, but the real black hat I'm wearing now is because I'm in mourning for the passing of my father onto a different plane. I'm saying hallelujah to my father. And as a physician involved in oncology and geriatrics, I was able to experience the hospice experience as a son rather than as a physician. Am I talking too loud? I'll speak more quietly. But first, I was also given the job of being the discussant. That's a very interesting job. You get to critique or to comment on things that everyone else has said, and no one can answer you. It's almost better than my marriage, where my wife always comments on me, and she's not here, so I can get away by saying that. Now, many years ago, I gave a lecture to the Wurzweiler School of Social Work, and there were hundreds of people sitting in the audience, hundreds of social workers, and I asked the question, I would like to ask the same question here. How many people here in the audience think you're going to die at home surrounded by your loved ones? This is good. Then everybody raised their hands. And I said 75% of you lower your hands because most of us are not going to die at home. And that's an unfortunate circumstance. We're going to die in hospitals, we're going to die in nursing homes, and I hope this doesn't come as a shock to everyone. We're all going to die. There's a great, and we'll get into this a little later, about to tell or not to tell. One of the things I tell all my patients in my office, even if they're 18 or 19, to quote a colleague of mine, life is a fatal disease. No one lives forever. We're all going to die. The great fear of death is not dying, especially in the Jewish religion. We firmly believe that where we're going, to quote A Tale of Two Cities, is a far better place than we are now. And yet none of us is in a rush to leave. None of us is in a rush to leave. By the way, I'm not a rabbi. And when I have questions in regards to a lot of the issues that are discussed, I have my rabbi who I ask my questions to, and I share that information with patients, with families, and I invite them to have their rabbi call me so I can discuss the medical issues. Many times I get families who come to me who say, well, the rabbi said this and the rabbi said that. And I said, that's sort of strange. The rabbi didn't ask me what the medical problems are. How is he giving you answers when he doesn't know what the question is? He knows what the family side of the question is, but doesn't know the medical facts. And it's very hard for a rabbi to answer a proper answer. Therefore, most competent rabbis will always arrange to speak with the physician, with the healthcare providers, and before they arrive at their question. By the way, I would like to compliment Mr. Beck on the excellent program tonight. I am familiar with all the agencies involved. They are all very good agencies. I think you could tell from the tone of each presenter that these agencies and the rabbis involved with these questions are all caring people. And that's really what the people up here are all about. We're here for caring for people, whether we're on the physician level, whether we're the administrators of the home care agencies, or we're the deliverers of care of the home care, or the hospice. When Reuven showed me the original program and he said home care and hospice care, I said these are two very different issues. One are people who are going to be living a long time, and the others are people who are going to be living a very short time. I said, but the real emphasis is probably the fact that we would all rather be cared for at home. That's what Dorothy learned in The Wizard of Oz. There's no place like home. Home is where we're comfortable. Hospitals are strange places, strange people coming in. People come in, we don't know who they are, what are they doing to me. At least at home we have some control, we have some independence. In hospitals there's loss of control, in nursing homes there's tremendous loss of control. Now, part of the problems, and let's focus a little on home care now, part of the problems as a physician who has to deal with providing or at least getting or arranging home care for patients is it's not as simple as everyone says it is, and there are a few things left out. And consumers need to be aware of this. Number one, there's a tremendous amount of paperwork. When you deal with Medicare, when you deal with Medicaid, there are forms on top of forms on top of forms that physicians have to certify. It's gotten to the point, unfortunately, where most physicians don't even read the forms to see what they're signing up on. They just sign the form. Now, it becomes tedious, very tedious. And on an average day in my office, I would say I get between 15 and 20 forms that starts the day off. Before I've seen a patient, before I've opened the chart, I've got 15 to 20 home care forms, which for some reason have to get renewed every 3 to 6 months. For some reason, I always have to pull out charts, look at the medicines to see if they're proper, look at the forms. I'm getting calls from nurses after I've signed the form. I get another copy of the form, and then I get a nurse calling to review the form a third time, and it gets tedious. And that may be one of the reasons, if you are waiting for a physician to sign a form, why that's happening. There's a tremendous amount of bureaucracy, unfortunately, whenever we deal with third-party payers. And it's difficult. And no doctor wants to be a mean guy and not sign them. But it's endless and it's problematic. Hopefully, as we get more computerized and we're able to perhaps speed things along internet-wise, these will improve. But this is something that you folks need to talk to your politicians about, because Medicare is a federal agency, Medicaid is a state agency, and these bureaucrats answer to government, and it's government that's going to make the changes when there's enough outcry from the general population. Now, why is that important? Well, it's important because if you look at my beard, I just turned 50. My beard is graying, my hair is leaving, and I just got an invitation to join AARP. Now, I'm an active physician, I'm not planning on retiring, but America is growing older, and need for home care is growing greater. It is growing greater. And you heard the statistics. And these are very important statistics. More and more people will be needing home care, especially in light of the fact that HMOs are running the insurance of hospitals and people are being sent out of hospitals to quote Senator Bud Pepper quicker and sicker. And people who get home sicker will need more home care. And Medicare will give you 60 days or 90 days, and you don't want to go into a nursing home, you don't want to go into a long-term care facility, you'd rather be home, but what happens when you run out of coverage? And then you have to spend the money that you either want to leave for your children, or you're putting away that you don't go destitute and have to stand on a street corner and sell flowers or pencils and beg for money. This money is put away for your old age, and while, yes, I agree that obviously a person who's sick should expend his own money before he expends his neighbor's money, because I mean taxes, the dignity, as has been mentioned, dignity of older people is very important. The caregivers who have to provide the care. Yes, home care is there, but as you heard, it's rare that a person will get 24 hours of home care. So, the children, and we heard the problems that can impact if the children are working. We heard the problems that can happen when there aren't children. And these are things that have to be addressed. Judy Brickman talked about Medicare home care, and we talked about oxygen. I need to talk a little bit about oxygen. Oxygen is very important to people. Now, there's a Medicare rule, and Medicare says that in the hospital, before a person gets oxygen at home, we have to test the blood of a patient, and there is a level of oxygen in the blood below which the patient is entitled to Medicare oxygen at home. And so I had an elderly woman who had metastatic lung cancer, and half the lung was gone with cancer, and she couldn't take one step without gasping for breath. Yet her number, when she sat down, her number was 1 point above that magic number, and therefore, Medicare wouldn't pay for her oxygen. And I had to keep her in the hospital an extra 10 days while we tried to figure out how to get this lady oxygen at home, because she needed oxygen at home, and it turns out that her son went into bankruptcy to get the oxygen for her mother, for his mother to be able to go home. Once again, this is something that we physicians need to alert the community, because sometimes some of these rules, these rigid rules that Medicare has, need to be changed for compassion, for dignity, and these are things that Now, I, as a member of the community, have to fight and get you people involved with it to change some of these foolish rules. There's only one problem. The Social Security Fund is in danger of going bankrupt itself. And we hear about how all the politicians-to-be are trying to figure out how to keep Social Security going. As America grays, more of the costs are going up. And how are we going to offset the need for more care with limited funds? I don't have a good answer for that, but then again, I'm not running for Senator of New York. Okay. Yes. Yeah. One of the problems, as you heard, is the need for nurses to go out and assess the home situation. This is critically important because as patients leave the hospital, we really don't know what the apartment looks like. We don't know what the social circumstances are, and therefore the need for a skilled professional to assess a home situation before home care comes in is critically important. And the family has to help out in this regard. Many times you have families who won't let these people come in to evaluate what the needs are, and then it becomes very difficult to treat patients. Now, Mr. Gibbons said the doctor is the captain of the ship. I find in regards to home care, the visiting nurse is the captain of the ship. I get to sign a lot of forms, and I readily admit that I work with the nurse. Skilled nursing is called skilled nursing. Nursing homes are called nursing homes. Many times, I mean, we doctors will see the patient for 5 minutes, and the nurse has a long-term relationship. So those of us who know when to be modest know that nurses are probably far more important. Okay. So as consumers, you need to be educated, and I thank you all for coming here. It's sort of overwhelming, all the amount of information you got, but perhaps you'll walk out of here a little smarter, and as Cy Sim says, educated consumers are the best customers, and that is very important. Now, one comment, and this is an unfortunate comment, but it even happened in my parents' house that nobody touched on to a great extent, except for the fact that there's not going to be an ethics code. One of the problems that people have hesitancy to let strangers into the house is unfortunately you have to watch everything in the house. It's a big problem. It's a problem that shouldn't exist, but it does exist. My father had his watch stolen off his night table. We don't know by whom. All the home care people who were in my parents' house for his sojourn, I thought were really nice people. The problem is that even the best of persons sometimes put into a situation gives in to his evil inclinations. And that's a problem, it's a real problem, and I think that's a problem that somehow has to get addressed better. I know when patients of mine have babies, I warn them to have to baby-proof the house. So somehow, this is something that needs to be addressed, to put away things that you're concerned about, and then you have a trade-off of what's important and what's not important. As I say, this is something that should need to be discussed, but it's a real concern and it really happens. So please be aware of it. Now, you've heard about hospice, and I will switch over to hospice a little bit. Hospice came up in the 1800s and it was not a Jewish concept. It was not a Jewish concept, and that's probably why it took a while for Judaism to get into the hospice concept. And as you heard, hospice is a concept. It's not a place. It is not a hospital. It is not a bed outside of home. The theory of hospice is to allow a patient to stay home as much as possible and to provide maximum service. It's unfortunate that every person can't take advantage of the hospice concept, because what hospice does is provide the patient with everything they need. Too bad we can't do that with every patient, give them everything they need. Unfortunately, as in many times in experimental therapy, we always start with the terminal patients first, and then it filters backwards. Why should any patient get nurses coming to the house, get social workers arranging things? That's what healthcare should be all about. The problem is that society was too concerned that we're spending too much money on healthcare. Well, what else should we spend it on? B1 bombs? We really need to have more emphasis governmental-wise on healthcare. The HMOs, unfortunately, are more interested in making profit than providing healthcare. And this is another problem. Hospice is a wonderful concept. It's a wonderful concept. It is not a terminal care facility, which is a hospital where people go to die, a terminal care facility, but it is a way of providing the dignity of life to people in the last part of their life. And I will contrast my father-in-law, Olva Sholem, and my father, Harim Kapers Tishkovo. 10 years ago, I diagnosed my father-in-law's metastatic lung cancer to his brain at age 82 because he smoked when he was in his 20s. He was a very intelligent person, and I sat down at his bedside at the hospital, and I asked him, do you want to know or do you not want to know? And he elected to know. And I told him what he had. And he told me three things. Number one, he didn't want to be in pain. Number two, he didn't want the family to suffer. And number three, don't resuscitate him when the end came. I was able to fulfill all his three requests. He went home with home care. He was able to spend 3 weeks out of the hospital. He went to two family simchas. He said goodbye to everybody. And then he went back into the hospital 10 years ago and died a week later. So in him, knowing helped him. My father, who passed away, or passed on rather, about 3.5 to 4 months ago, my mother felt that he wouldn't tolerate the news well, and she insisted on his not knowing. I, as an oncologist and a geriatrician, was very opposed to this. But I asked the rabbi, he was coordinating the care on his case, and he said, follow what your mother's wishes are. I was the last child to see my father. I saw him Erev Shabbos, and he passed away Shabbos night. And my mother thanked me for coming over. To that day, when he asked what's wrong with me, I withheld part of the truth. I told him he needed to get better. I told him he had infection, he needed to drink more, eat more, etc., etc., etc. He did not know, and I think his life was extended because of it. So there is no right to know. Every case has to be looked at individually. Obviously, discussions have to be held between the healthcare team, the family, the rabbis, the priests, whoever else is involved. In this case, I was a son rather than a physician. But the family came to a consensus. I disagreed with it. The family knew about it. But I went along with the family's decision, and I think it was the right thing. So let's talk a little bit about my dad, because that's the son's tale was added on. My dad, 2 years ago, Rosh Hashanah, went into Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital for surgery and was found to have inoperable pancreatic carcinoma. Now that diagnosis usually means a patient's going to die within 3 months, but his cancer was not at the head of the pancreas where it obstructed, it was in the tail of the pancreas where it was growing into his spine and into his back. Of interest, he didn't have much pain. He had nonstop hiccups. For those of you who are unaware, nonstop hiccups is a terrible, terrible calamity. Can't breathe, a lot of trouble. He was on various medications. I want to thank all the people really involved in his care, because Parkway Hospital was involved in his care. They helped out a great deal. Visiting Nurse Service was involved, and they helped out a great deal. In fact, they were involved at the very terminal part of his life. And then the Jewish Hospice. By the way, I sit on the board of the Queens Board of Hospice, because I think that hospice is vitally important, vitally important. Now, my dad became dehydrated, and as you heard from Halacha, dehydration is not a way that we like patients to go, because it means we're sort of neglecting them halachically. And so we looked around how to get him on intravenous. And of course, as many times medical problems happen, it was Friday afternoon, 2 hours to Shabbos. I called Jewish Hospice, and I think it was a holiday weekend to boot. I called Jewish Hospice and I said, I realize it's very short-term time. My dad needs an intravenous for hydration. Because looking at him, putting my physician cap on, I didn't think he'd live out the weekend. Hospice came, intravenous was started. My dad survived the weekend and many months afterwards. Now, philosophically, people might argue with that. He had a terminal illness. He had already not responded to chemotherapy. Why did we do that? Well, we did it for various reasons. One reason was my father was able to put on house and fill in many more days. And none of us knows what the value of what we do, the little things that we can do. He was able to say to Chavez to the family many weekends. Rabbi Cook, that saying, Bidui, my father was very lucky. Three different rabbanim came on three different occasions, each one not knowing that other people, my father said Bidui three times. Three times. How that score is up in heaven, I don't know. It was probably good. He was able to attend family simchas. He was able to participate with the family. And most importantly, we were able to be with him. Somebody needs to change a tape. Having been an oncologist now some 20 years and dealing with death all the time, and I can deal with death fairly easily. I can talk to patients and I can talk to families. I can use that horrible C word because cancer is a reality and we're making progress in cancer. But as I mentioned earlier, we're all going to die, and unfortunately today I had to tell someone, and I won't say anything more, that he has a mass in the head of his pancreas. So today I'm reliving what happened to my father about 2 years ago with someone who's been a patient of mine for 18 years, who otherwise was basically fine, and I have to deal with a hysterical family and a hysterical patient. But as a professional, I can deal with that. As a son who, on a Friday, was a son, and on a Saturday night was an orphan, as a family member and as a consumer, it's a whole different ballgame. And that's why I felt it important for me to give you my input as a son. Hospice, where I have to fight with Jewish patients about hospice. Hospice allows a person great dignity, great caring, great compassion. Great compassion. And there is no halachic reason why hospice shouldn't be embraced by the Jewish community. And that's why when Mr. Barron started the Queen's Board for Jewish Hospice, I was happy to join and lend my expertise. The hospice works by halacha. The hospice allows things, the Jewish hospice, that some other hospices won't allow. Other hospices won't allow intravenous. However, I encourage you all, and let me summarize by saying that whether it's home care or whether it's hospice care, to give a person dignity in his life, whether he is in his regular lifespan or towards the end of his lifespan, home care is important. I have a Jewish lady, a very proud Jewish lady on the Lower East Side. She's blind. Her niece, who's her caregiver, is blind. She was eligible for Medicare many years ago, but being a proud Jewish lady, she refused to take assistance. Despite my telling her I could get her medications for free and she couldn't afford them. Despite my telling her I could get her much more home care for her, which she refused to take. All right? Sometimes these concepts to us Jews is an alien concept. We usually don't look for handouts. However, these are services that we have all worked for as tax-paying citizens. It's not a handout. You've worked for this. You're entitled to this. It's there for the asking. We're all here. My number is not on the back because I didn't bring any business cards to put on the back and they're in my other jacket. But most of the people I think in the community know who I am. I'm always available to help out as best I can. I thank you all for coming. Rabbi Ruben Becker is going to close, and I request if we can have 9 other males here. I need to stop in my to say Kaddish. Thank you very much.
Also, to make a particular thank you to all the participants and all the presenters, both in terms of their very, very scholarly and informative presentation at this moment, but also with regard to their advice and direction in planning this event. Thank you all. Thank you all for coming. Have a good evening.